These are African rhythms.
From WSNC 90.5 FM, a broadcasting service and NPR affiliate of Winston-Salem State University, welcome to Africa World Now Project. I'm your host and producer, James Pope. Today, the life and legacy of Carter G. Woodson with Dr. Greg Carr. Africa World Now Project is next. Get on. When thinking of history, one tends to categorize or disassociate the contextual conditions that create and propel phenomena and phenomenon that move across time and space. Events and thoughts are relegated to a disassociated moment, mapped on categories of time that have been redefined to fit a particular worldview. Western historiography and historicity and its notion of modernity. The concept is stripped of its promise of futurity. I have stated before and will state again, the perspective of history that holds together the web of the past, present, and future is the one presented by John Henry Clark. He writes, "History is not everything, but it is a starting point. History is a clock that people use to tell their political and cultural time of day. It is a compass they use to find themselves on the map of human geography. It tells them where they are, but more importantly, what they must be." It is precisely because of this, I argue that those who are interested in Black history should also be concerned with an Africana future. Of the many places we can start to understand the nexus of time and space, and given what this month has come to mean for many, it is appropriate and necessary to think about the life and legacy of Carter G. Woodson. Today, we will explore the very ideas I just presented with Dr. Greg Carr through a lecture he conducted a few years ago that deeply explored in depth the life, impact, legacy, and intellectual genealogy of Carter G. Woodson. Dr. Greg Carr is an associate professor of Africana Studies and chair of the Department of Afro-American Studies at Howard University, as well as adjunct faculty at the Howard School of Law. He holds a PhD in African American Studies from Temple University and a JD from the Ohio State University College of Law. From 1999 to 2000, as Philadelphia's first resident scholar on race and culture, Dr. Carr led a team in the design of the curriculum framework for Philadelphia's mandatory high school African American history course. He is a co-founder of the Philadelphia Freedom Schools movement and has presented his curriculum work to the Board of Public Education in Salvador, Bahia, Brazil. Having lectured across the U.S., Ghana, Egypt, South Africa, Brazil, France, and England, his work has appeared in the African American Studies Reader, Socialism and Democracy, publications of the Modern Language Association of America, and Malcolm X, a Historical Reader, to name a few. Dr. Carr is the first vice president of the Association for the Study of Classical African Civilization and a former member of the board of the National Council for Black Studies. Having been named Professor of the Year three times by the Howard University Student Association, the College of Arts and Sciences Students Council, and the College of Arts and Sciences Honors Association. He has led or co-led student research and study programs to South Africa and Egypt. Dr. Carr is coordinator of the COAS Mellon Interdisciplinary Research Course Initiative at Howard University, co-editor of the Association for the Study of Classical African Civilizations, multi-volume African World History Project, and has appeared and or been featured in Ebony Magazine, The New York Times, Washington Post, Le Monde, USA Today, MSNBC, National Public Radio, BBC America, C-SPAN, MTVU, Voice of America, as well as a range of other multimedia outlets. Our show is produced today in solidarity with the Native, Indigenous, African, and Afro-descendant communities at Standing Rock, Venezuela, Corporation Jackson in Jackson, Mississippi, Brazil, the Avalon Village in Detroit, Colombia, Kenya, Palestine, South Africa, and Ghana, and other places who are fighting for the protection of our land for the benefit of all peoples. Enjoy the show.
I knew after my second year of law school I didn't want to be a lawyer. And I spent that summer in New York. Spent a lot of time at the ASCAC study group, First World Alliance. Brother Hannibal, that's his old digs back there in Manhattan. That's when they were meeting at 145th and Convent. We had a white Jesus up in the church, and Dr. Ben used to come in there and rail against it, and people would remind him that these people are letting us use this church. But he didn't care then and doesn't care now. It's a beautiful thing. But if you can imagine, and I know many of you all have been to First World, sitting on the floor, I mean, you get there and there's nowhere to sit. So, but I like that, because I would come right down front and get cross-legged with my tape recorder and something they had cassette tapes then. I guess they still have a few of them now around. And listen to John Henry Clark or Dr. Ben. And when Dr. Clark said all he ever wanted to be was a great classroom teacher, that's really what made up my mind for me, that's what I wanted to be. And I followed him around mercilessly, you know, to the degree that I'm from the South, so I got home training. I know not to bother old folks all the time. And when you talk to them, have something to say. So I didn't ever say anything like, Dr. Clark, tell me, man, why did you become a teacher? No, you can read what he wrote. I need to be very specific about this. Okay, Ms. Evelina Taylor, the third grade, what was it that she said to you? In other words, I'm going to respect you enough to read what you wrote before I come asking questions. So as a consequence, he kind of took a liking to me, and I got a little bit of an apprenticeship, again, which is why I can distinguish sometimes between a teacher and somebody who said he a teacher. I speak Ebonics, so, when somebody said he called himself a teacher, I know what they've said. That's different than he's a teacher. You understand? Some people call themselves teachers. John Clark was not one of those people. And in listening to him talk and asking him questions, I got inspired. I said, I'm going to go to graduate school. So I enrolled and got a master's in African American Studies from Ohio State, since I was out there anyway. And the reason I bring that up in relation to Woodson is because after my first semester in my master's program in December 1990, I turned my last paper in, and I was, everybody here has been in school, you just be spent, that's it. I left it all on the floor. So I got in the car, and I just drove around Columbus. Not many places to go in Columbus on Friday night, unless you're just looking for trouble in some ways. And I wasn't the kind to hang out with my peers. Something about African American Studies, master's and PhD programs, and marijuana that just seems to be, I don't know what it is about drug abuse. Maybe they think that's what black people are supposed to do. But unlike Barry Obama, there's a front page article in the Times today about Obama and smoking weed and taking cocaine, and none of his peers seem to remember him doing that a lot. So they're saying that maybe he even made that part up to look legit. I mean, who thought we would live in a day when a black man could talk about smoking weed and nobody would back him up on it? And so now they're trying to see whether he was as bad as he says he was. Oh, we living in strange times. But at any rate, so I know where they were, but I knew where I wasn't going. So I went to the library and I checked out a book by these two old white dudes, August Meyer and Elliot Rudwick. Black History and the Historical Profession, 1915 and 1980. I was struck by the title because obviously it's black history. But after the conjunction, an article, and the, it says historical perfection, a profession, and of course, conjunction, but the article the, not a historical perfection, not some, the historical, meaning what? Okay, what is this about? Historical profession, the study of history, professional study of history, must be 1950 to 1980. Well, I knew enough then to know, 1950, that's when Booker T. Washington died. Maybe this is going to be about 1980? So I opened up, looked at the table of contents, chapter one, Carter G. Woodson as entrepreneur, laying the foundation of a historical specialty. So I'm standing in the library. I look at the acknowledgments. Then I opened the book, so let me read a little bit of this. Chapter one, Carter G. Woodson as entrepreneur, laying the foundation of a historical specialty. I'm just going to read one sentence. At that point, I closed the book, went, checked it out, took it home, and wrote all in the margins, underlined, wrote down everything. Every page on this book is somebody who wrote what they wrote, when they wrote it, who trained them, what the publication was, and then set about going into the footnotes and trying to find a copy of everything they had in this 350-page book. And I got most of this stuff now. Again, it's not a game. Why? John Henry Clark said, you gotta keep your library in your head. So this book is really a long bibliographic essay. But what made me close the book and take it home? First sentence. The career of Carter Godwin Woodson, 1875 to 1950, W.E.B. Du Bois observed, just after the founder of the Association for the Study of Negro Life and History had died in 1950, quote, illustrates what race prejudice can do to a human soul, and also what it is powerless to prevent, unquote. I'm taking this home. In other words, the white man, no. This is what it can do to you, and this is what it has no power to stop. That is Now, mind you, Du Bois and Woodson really didn't get along too well. In fact, Woodson didn't get along with a whole lot of people. In fact, when Woodson died, Du Bois wrote that obituary, because now I have the volumes in which that obituary is reprinted. It's from Masses and Mainstream, 1950, and it was republished in a little volume called W.B. Du Bois Publications and Journals Edited by Others. It cost me a lot of money over the years to get all this stuff, but I think I did just about all of it. And when you're reading what he wrote, and then when you go to his correspondence, you gotta go to the three volumes of W.B. Du Bois' correspondence, see the letters he sent out to try to find out who Carl G. Woodson was. When he writes to Rayford Logan, and he writes to Lorenzo Green, and they write him back, and Woodson is like, Du Bois is like, well, what do you know of Carter Woodson? And then Logan writes him back and says, well, you know, I was closer to him than most, maybe even all. I don't know what he liked to do. Du Bois asked, well, did he like baseball? Did he like ice cream? What? Logan writes back, well, sir, I don't remember him taking recreation. This is a man who lived with Carter Woodson at the house on 9th Street. I don't remember him much going for recreation and sport. I'm not sure. This is before the publication of two big volumes by Lorenzo Johnson Green. Lorenzo Green was one of Woodson's students who eventually published a book called The Negro in New England. Lorenzo Green was a college student who lived with Woodson in D.C. Lorenzo Green kept a diary, or journal, whichever you want to call it. But, of course, the old man didn't know. He would come write in his journal. Eventually, Arvi Strickland, who's still alive, Arvi Strickland now is an advanced age at University of Missouri, Columbia. I remember meeting him and thanking him profusely for editing those two volumes. He didn't know me from a can of paint, but it wasn't important. He needed to hear thanks. Because sometimes people write books and nobody read them. I've thanked people for books and asked them questions about their books and seen them reduced to tears. They said, you read that? In fact, I'll tell you this quick story, 30-second story. Clyde Taylor, who wrote a very important book, The Mask of Art, very important book on meaning-making and aesthetics. I had my students at Howard read it. And when he came, they asked him to come to Howard. He came to Howard and saw a room full of 19, 20, 21-year-olds who had read his book, one of the most important books really on black aesthetics I think ever been written. He was like, they read my book. And you could tell he wanted to cry, but he just couldn't do it in front of all these strangers. So he had to stop and compose himself. He said, I wrote something. I figured when I wrote this, it was so far out beyond what everybody was writing that maybe one day they would return to it. I didn't think anybody was going to read it during my lifetime, not this way. It's very moving. But at any rate, Lorenzo Green didn't keep a journal that I'm sure Woodson knew was going, he didn't know he had a journal. But what we have with Lorenzo Green's two volumes, one is called Working with the Father of Black History, the other one is called Selling Black History. Because what they would do as young men was go out in the summertime and sell copies of the books Woodson had written to get money for the association, and to, with that money for the association, Woodson would get in part of the money, and Brian knows, he's read those journals, he would use part of that money to finance their graduate education because he was training the next generation of scholars. That's who these young guys were. But he wasn't just training them to be scholars. He was training them to work, their work ethic. They had to get up, sweep the floors, clean the place, take out the trash, and in the summertime, they gas up the car and go driving through Virginia and South Carolina, go driving through North Carolina, come through Tennessee, selling books door to door. Many people couldn't read. Many people just learned to read. Their children in school, they say, would you like to buy a copy of The Negro in Our History? And they wouldn't keep all the books. They would have demonstration copies back then, which meant a book like this, they may have the first 20 pages and maybe 5 pages of three chapters, and it'd be in a little hardback, and they would show it to people, and people would subscribe, and then once they got the money, they would come back, print the books up, and send them, or bring them back. They would set up meetings with churches, going to people's churches, going to the segregated schools, and put on demonstrations for school teachers. They would have, the car in the back would have displays that they would unfold and show, and these were young guys, and then when they finished, they would come back to D.C. and continue their research, and then when it's time to go to school, Woodson would help them pay for graduate school. This is what it means to build a movement. I'm not impressed by individuals who go out by themselves and write to themselves and then go out and tell people how great I am. As Kara West once said, you know, I'm so-and-so, I'm this, I'm that. It's not very impressive to me anyway. You can write and work in isolation, but what have you done to train the next generation? So that they came out of that experience not just with scholarship, but with a work ethic. And anytime Lorenzo Johnson Green went looking for Carter Woodson, he knew where he was. Either at his desk, or sweeping the floor himself, or in the basement, boxing up books to sell. But he didn't see him sleep or take a nap. Why? Because ain't with nobody going to outwork Woodson. You might take a nap, but as the story they tell in the Nation of Islam about Elijah Muhammad said when he was getting trained by Master Fard, or at least as the folklore goes, Fard, he's never saw Fard sleep. So he one night he snuck up to Fard's bedroom and looked through the keyhole to see if he could catch Fard sleep, and there was Fard sitting in a chair in the middle of the room looking back through the keyhole at him. Elijah Muhammad was the best storyteller there was. In other words, you're not going to catch Carter G. Woodson. Just when you think, man, this guy, when does he sleep? Rayford Logan, who got caught between Du Bois and Woodson on some things, who was still his friend, told Du Bois, I don't know what he did for recreation. But anyway, when you read the journals, you see that Woodson was deliberate in his work and that he was very intolerant. Oh, I can't defend Carter Woodson. It's fascinating. He was a human being. Meaning, you know, we all have our challenges. I remember one passage in the first volume, working with Carter G. Woodson, the father of black history is what they called it. He was there for a couple of years at first time. I think maybe 1928 to 1930. You can check the dates on the journal. Green says that Woodson got in an argument with Charles Wesley. And Woodson and Wesley wrote The Negro in Our History. But Charles Wesley was very different. Charles Wesley was brilliant. Some of y'all, I don't know, does anybody here know, did you know Charles Wesley when he was here in Philadelphia? He was the first director of the museum in 76. So somebody here may have seen him. Charles Wesley, a remarkable figure in his own right, one of the great chroniclers of the African U.S. social elite. So he wrote the history of the Prince Hall Masons, the Elks. He wrote the history of Alpha Alpha. He wrote the history of Sigma Pi Phi. He wrote the history of the ME Church. He wrote the history of Prince Hall, Richard Allen. I mean, it's like, this guy is so productive. But he was also an ME Church minister. He also became the president of Wilberforce University at some point. Have you ever seen pictures of him? Very awesome, very suave, kind of, almost looked like maybe a Harry Lennox kind of, you know who Harry Lennox is, right? Playing the Five Heartbeats, the dude with the deep voice. He's about to play Duke Ellington. Played Adam Clayton Powell in the Keep the Faith Baby. He that kind of, you know, suave kind of dude. You see Charles Wesley. This is a guy who not only was very bright, but also, let's say, he's a social butterfly of sorts. Well, so Woodson wanted him for his mind and his work ethic, but he detested the fact that Wesley was also social. So Green overheard Wesley arguing with Woodson. Woodson telling Wesley, not serious. You need to let some of this other stuff go and concentrate on the work. I need a history of the black church. Now you are going, what you going to do this? Now you going to be a preacher? These are two men, these are two giants in the field arguing, and it isn't really Wesley arguing, it's Woodson. Finally, Wesley said, I don't have to listen to this, and left. He had to understand that for about 18 months, Carter Woodson worked as a dean at Howard University. At the end of which, he said, I can't do this no more. There's a letter, Moreland Spingarn has some of that correspondence. There's a letter that was sent to Woodson chastising him from the Howard administration because one of the responsibilities of the dean during this period was to go to chapel and make sure the faculty went. And yeah, because they had to go to chapel, Negro College. Woodson was mad because he went to chapel. First of all, he didn't want to go. He said, I don't go to chapel and check up on grown folks. Apparently there was a dispute with Alain Locke. Alain Locke was Baha'i. And he wasn't going to chapel unless he felt like it. And so Woodson, among other things, took offense. Why I gotta go and tell on Alain Locke? Look, these kind of things piled up after a while. Woodson said, okay, that's it. I can't get any research done. I got all these students I'm trying to administer. He was the first one to introduce African-American history as a formal course at black colleges. The first one to put it in curriculum anywhere during that period. But he left. And he had a house on 9th Street. He lived on the top floor. The next two floors in the basement were the association's offices. And that's where they found him dead in April 1950. He worked there for the rest of his life. Never married, never had any kids. And so when he passed, as I say, Logan didn't know. But you know, when you look, it's very fascinating to me. In writing this lesson, in 1937, Woodson started a publication. I'm gonna go through some of the dates in a second. He started a publication called the Negro History Bulletin. That publication was primarily for school teachers. It was for teachers to submit articles and to get articles they could use in the classroom. He wrote curriculum. He didn't do it by himself, he edited it. school teachers from around the country and scholars from around the country and around the world gave articles about famous black people, famous events. You read about blacks in Latin America, the Caribbean, ancient Africa, all this in this magazine, the Negro History Bulletin. And then the little kids started writing. They had crossword puzzles and questions you could ask young people. And then students would submit for essay competitions. And then they would talk about Negro History Week this year and take pictures. Here's a school, here's a classroom in Richmond, Virginia. Here's Cincinnati, Ohio. Here's one in Baton Rouge, Louisiana. And you would see these little vignettes from people. And classes would get together and say, here's what we did. And it's like, wow, this is, it's really rich. And it's all on microfilm, but you know, I want the book. So I buy them whenever I can find them. They come in the little volume. So I have a number of them at the house. And I'll never forget when I finally bought the one, I've really been looking for this volume, because this is the volume from 1950. It's published every month, and then at one point every other month. 1950, Woodson died in April. So I want to see May, June, July, 1950. When I looked in there, tributes to Woodson came from the children. And among those tributes were a tribute by a couple of young people, little girls, who knew Carter G. Woodson. And they said he used to come around and take us out for ice cream. It's Washington, D.C. You couldn't find who Woodson hung out with from the adults. When you go through the record, what you find out with, if he spent any rec time at all, he spent at least that time with young people. And not teenagers, he had the youngsters he was training, the college students, the little kids. And I said, well, there he is right there. Never had gotten married, never had any children of his own, but his singular focus was on these young people in that, at that moment, and I'll bracket that in a second, because, you know, our elders and our children are the ones who are closest to that space that we all connect with all the time, but to which we all return and out of which we all come back. And the Kikongo, the Yoruba, everybody would say is so significant. And Woodson seemed to live that way because he had a special place in his life for these two groups, and it'll become more evident in a second. So Carter Woodson, let me give a couple of biographical dates and then we'll go forward. Actually, I've kind of set most of the markers out. I'm thinking about how things, just when we encourage each other and keep our spirits up. And I know everybody in here has had encouragement from the ancestral realm in any number of ways. I should mention this while I'm thinking about it. This book that I mentioned, Black History and the Historical Profession, written by two white dudes, August Meyer and Elliot Rudwick. Meyer and Rudwick, for a number of years, were at Kent State University, Kent, Ohio. August Meyer passed away a couple of years ago, Alzheimer's. Spent the last years of his life in a nursing home in New York State. When I first went to Kent State back in the early 90s for a conference, Ed Crosby and some of the people who Pan-African Center there, you know, any place I go to, I'm asked where the bookstore is. So I went to the bookstore, and anytime I go to the bookstore, if I'm going to give a paper or a talk, I try to go to the bookstore before the talk so that the people from there, I can say, now I'm ashamed, you should be ashamed that I came into your city and bought this book and this book and this book. How did I go to the bookstore and find these books? Y'all must already have it. So that happened at Kent State. Old white boy with a ponytail. Well, I almost looked like Shaggy, all Scooby-Doo. Except he had his hair back in a ponytail, like one of them deadheads or something, you know. I go into place. Can I help you? No, I'm just looking. I'm gonna look at all the places, and then if I don't see what I want, I'll come back and ask you. Get to the back, and there's these old books, one big thick book, Bibliography of the Negro in Africa and America, republished by Octagon Press, but it's a reprint of a book that was published, the first major bibliography on African people in the Western Hemisphere, compiled by a dude named Monroe Work. Monroe Work was the director of records and research at Tuskegee for a number of years and a good friend of Carter Woodson, who also didn't know anything about him. But I bought that book, a couple of other books, and I asked the guy, I said, man, this book is so rare, even the reprint, because it hasn't been reprinted. I think the Octagon Press reprint was maybe 67. It hasn't been reprinted. It's a very important book, because Work tried to put in that book every book he was aware of in English and some in other languages, but certainly every book in English that had anything to do with black people. So it's a compendium of all the books at that time. I think the original bibliography was published in the late 20s, 1920s. So he said, oh, those are some of Augie's books that he sold off. August Meyer? Yeah, he lives around here. Huh. Okay, thank you. That was years ago. I didn't know Meyer was sick because he disappeared. I don't know August Meyer, never saw him. One other thing about August Meyer, he came to prominence because Dorothy Porter Wesley, the world is so small. Dorothy Porter Wesley was married to Charles Wesley, but Charles Wesley was her last husband of several. The Porter in her name was for James Porter, who was an art historian at Howard, who she married and died, then she married Charles Wesley, another of her husbands among several. She was the director of the Moreland Spingarn Library at Howard. Moreland Spingarn, out of the side of Schaumburg, is probably the best repository of Africana in the United States. Jesse Moreland was the secretary of the YMCA, the colored YMCA, and he was one of the founders of the Association for the Study of Negro Life and History with Carter Woodson in 1915 on Wabash Avenue in Chicago at the Black YMCA. He agreed to serve as secretary of the original association that Woodson founded, but he didn't really want to because he had been trying to persuade Woodson to take the association to Howard and start it there so he could have an institutional home. But Woodson's thing was, no, I'm not connecting it to anything because none of you Negroes can be trusted. At some point, you go for the money. As I said, Woodson didn't go get along with everybody. But Jesse Moreland did agree to work with the association, serve on its first board, and he eventually donated his books to Howard, forming the core of what became the Moreland Spingarn collection. The Spingarn part is from Joel Spingarn. Joel Spingarn and his brother were helpful founders of the NAACP, two white dudes. Major Spingarn, in fact, also spied on the NAACP and other black organizations for the United States military during World War I, unbeknownst to Du Bois and others who supported him, again, underscoring what Woodson was trying to tell them about alliances with our friends. But Spingarn had a big collection of Africana too. He donated it to Howard. So they put them together and called it the Moreland Spingarn Collection. Actually, Woodson won the Spingarn Medal in 1926. The NAACP named its highest honor the Spingarn Award. In fact, it's still the Spingarn Award. But at any rate, Du Bois put him up, nominated him for it. But I'll get to that in a second because he and Du Bois fell out, but that's about something else that Henry Louis Gates plays in that. We'll get to that in a second. In the process of working on his dissertation, August Meyer shows up at Howard. Mrs. Porter at the time, the librarian, knew where everything was in that collection. She'd worked there for a number of years. And when this young white boy showed up, who was working at Tougaloo, I think, at the time in Mississippi, he worked at black colleges a number of years, wrote his memoir, A White Scholar in the Black Community. I'll tie all this together in a second. He shows up, says, I want to write about black organizations, Negro organizations. Mrs. Porter is like, well, that's important and it's good work. But let me tell you, there are a number of black organizations that haven't been written about and a lot of figures that are very important. And you know, we have a lot of those documents here. In fact, let me show you. And she guided him through unprocessed materials and primary documents that enabled him to write a book called Negro Thought in America, from the 1880s to the death of Booker T. Washington in 1915, that set the standard for African-American history and helped train a generation of black scholars, including the author of the African-American history textbook we have, Darlene Clark Hine. So many of these black scholars bow down to August Meyer. He became known in some ways as the dean of African-American history because a black woman showed him where the documents were. It's very interesting. I ain't mad at August Meyer and I ain't mad at Dorothy Porter, but I'm just telling you the genealogy, which will become evident in a minute. So this book comes very important because he knows these documents. It's very important to read that. Oh, he's a white man, I'm not gonna read him. Okay, well then you go on over there into ignorance. I'm gonna read every page in here and get the documents back. Duh. But we'll go back and reconstruct them then. You go look for all the documents. I'm gonna start here. It's like reading a phone book, basically. But in this process, and Meyer was sick, didn't know he was sick. I was in New York, Strand Bookstore, my hands and knees. I see, copy of this. I got like two copies of it now. In fact, this is the one I went and bought after I marked up the library's copy. And I won't write in this one.
We are currently listening to The Life and Legacy of Carter G. Woodson as explored by Dr. Greg Carr. Dr. Carr is an associate professor of Africana Studies and chair of the Department of Afro-American Studies at Howard University, as well as adjunct faculty at the Howard School of Law. He holds a PhD in African American Studies from Temple University and a JD from the Ohio State University College of Law. Dr. Carr is the first vice president of the Association for the Study of Classical African Civilizations and former member of the board of the National Council for Black Studies. His work has appeared in the African American Studies Reader, Socialism and Democracy, publications of the Modern Language Association of America, and Malcolm X, a Historical Reader, to name a few. He is co-founder of the Philadelphia Freedom Schools Movement and has presented his curriculum work for the Board of Public Education in Salvador, Bahia, Brazil, as well as lectured across the U.S., Ghana, Egypt, South Africa, Brazil, France, and England. He has led or co-led student research and study programs to South Africa and Egypt, and is coordinator of the COAS Mellon Interdisciplinary Research Course Initiative at Howard University. He is the co-editor of the Association for the Study of Classical African Civilizations, multi-volume Africa World History Project, and has appeared and or been featured in Ebony Magazine, New York Times, Washington Post, USA Today, C-SPAN, MTVU, Voice of America, BBC America, MSNBC, CNN, and a range of other multimedia outlets. Our show was produced today in solidarity with the Native, Indigenous, African, and Afro-descendant communities at Standing Rock, Venezuela, Corporation Jackson in Jackson, Mississippi, Brazil, the Avalon Village in Detroit, Colombia, Kenya, Palestine, South Africa, and Ghana, and other places who are fighting for the protection of our land for the benefit of all peoples. Continue to enjoy the program.
So I didn't pay the rent. I had to borrow for the rent there, something, because I bought everything I could find that was inscribed to him. Why, here is the evidence, the smoking gun. You Negroes stand up. I see what you did. Now, I know it could have been gratuitous, but the thing that struck me as well is, how did August Meyer's books that were written, inscribed to him, end up here? He may have Alzheimer's and gone into another space, but what regard did his family have? Did they have to sell to pay the bills? Now, this guy was well off, well enough off. I don't know what the circumstances were, but it strikes me that as much as these black people love what you did for them, how come all the books at my house? You understand? I'm like, well, we doggone. But it closed full circle for me a couple of years ago, what began with this book. This is encouragement. I don't care about August Meyer. I could care less. But what that enabled me to re-inscribe in my mind is the importance of doing the work and understanding the implications, which brings me back to Woodson. I've never seen a Carnegie Woodson inscribed book, but I was in Emory about 3 years ago doing a workshop on Africana Studies for the Department of Africana Studies, and Emory, as you all probably know, university is Coca-Cola money, the Candler family. In fact, Asa was the Fuller E. Calloway Professor of Urban Education at Georgia State. They got a Calloway building at Emory. The Calloways, the Chandlers, the Candlers, all this stuff is interrelated. This Coca-Cola money, this South, this urban South, post-Civil War, Reconstruction, New South, not plantocracy, but these neo-Southern races. That's their thing. Emory is their flagship. I said, why y'all call it Emory? You should just call it Coca-Cola University. Be done with it. So they take me to the top floor of the library, special collections. This white boy named Randall Burkett, who used to work with Henry Louis Gates, is in charge of special collections. Rise 90 said, I know you know Burkett. I'm up there. Burkett loves bragging about how he got a blank checkbook to buy whatever he want black, including, painfully, much of the collection of the Association for the Study of Afro-American Life and History, who several years ago sold the private library of Carnegie Woodson to Emory University, because they needed money. That's their excuse. Anyway, I don't buy it, never will. But a lot of these Negroes are indeed the grandchildren of August Meyer. You see, so their idea of institution building has more to do with what book they published and what university they're at and how they can meet at conferences and be each other's friends than it does about building independent institutions, so that the founder of the association that they're now in charge of, his private library is down at Emory, sitting in a special collection being presided over by a vulture named Randall Burkett. Burkett brings out this book, W.C. Handy, Father of the Blues. On the title page it says, to the father of Negro history from the father of the blues, W.C. Handy. And he got it in his hands. And I just wanted to say, oh man, that's a but you can't do that. We're academics after all. So I couldn't take it from him, so I decided, well, okay, So I came out of my bag with a history of the story of Negro history, a description of the courses in Negro history being taught at black colleges around the country, edited by John G. Jackson and Willis Huggins. And he said, "Oh, can I see? I've heard of that." "Yeah, I'm sure you have. But you ain't gonna touch this. So go home tonight and sleep," because it's an obsession for him. He wants everything black he can find. The more rare, the better. He had a collection of stuff from an esotericist in Savannah, Georgia, including her crystal ball. He just tossing it around. "I wonder. Oh, I can't see anything." "Yeah, fool, keep handling it. When your fingers fall off in a couple of years and you go to that great Emory Hospital and they can't do nothing for you except send you home, the laughter you hear is going to be that black woman in your ear." But my point is that Woodson, I've never seen anything inscribed by him, but I've seen things inscribed to him. Woodson was part of a community that recognized his worth even if he wasn't close to anybody. And so let me kind of wind this together, and as I go through the chronology, it'll become very apparent. Carter Woodson, in the lesson that we wrote, comes alive, we hope, in ways that school teachers can use their young people, can use to help their young people ask different kind of questions. I won't read the lesson to you, but I'll read a couple of small passages. The beginning of the lesson starts with three quotes. The first one is probably the most important quote for February of any year, because we all laugh and tell the same jokes. It's the shortest month of the year. That's why it's Black History Month, this kind of thing. Negro History Week, this is from Woodson, editorial 1943, the Negro History Bulletin. "Negro History Week is the week set aside by the Association for the Study of Negro Life and History for the purpose of emphasizing what has already been learned about the Negro during the year." Well, there it is. This is the time when we're supposed to be talking about what we did the other 11 months. It's remarkable, isn't it? When you think about it, if Woodson was sitting here now, and of course he is here, but if he was physically sitting here, given his proclivity to be irascible and kind of cantankerous, I shudder to think. In fact, we included primary documents, as Dana always talks about with the school teachers. Here's something from March 1950. This is the month before he died, from the Negro History Bulletin. The title of this article: "No Study, and consequently, No Celebration." Woodson said, "Well, we didn't do our work this year, so I ain't gonna call off Negro History. We can't do it. It's too big now. But I really don't feel like celebrating." He says, "It is evident from the numerous calls for orators during Negro History Week that schools and their administrators do not take the study of the Negro seriously enough to use Negro History Week as a short period for demonstrating what the students have learned in their study of the Negro during the whole school year." So all these Negroes run around filling up their bank accounts and what they now take to call in behind people's backs. Green History Week? Green History Month? "Where you going this week? Where you going this week? Where you going this week? Where they paying you? I don't take money." I troll, man. Unless money falling out of people's pockets and they say, "You know, you have to take the money." Mm-mm. Woodson said, "It is evident from you asking all these people to come that y'all don't take doing it during the year seriously." I'm gonna blow that up and put it on there. "Who's coming for Negro History Week?" "Here." There you go, from the founder. "Don't call during February. March the 1st, phone better be ringing off the hook. Better yet, June 15th, August 23rd. Through that, April 15th, somebody say, "I want you to come in and talk about slavery as a function of the taxing power of the United States and how the American taxation system was built on the appropriation of African labor and how they built the tax code around that. Ultimately, a century later, when they put the federal income tax into place, it was built on the premise that this is how you build revenue. I need somebody black to tell me about that." Why? It's April 15th. This is a beautiful thing. I mean, Woodson, man, Woodson is no joke. He said, "Those with ambitions in the present will thus gain renewed vigor in their efforts to battle with present day obstacles and finally overcome in the struggle of life if you teach Negro youth their history year round." The purpose of doing it year round is so that they see every day examples of how to get out of the mess they're in. If you just keep it in that week, you just defeated the purpose. Rather, don't call me. Beautiful thing. This is from Carter Woodson. So at any rate, so we have that first quote. The second quote, "This is the meaning of Negro History Week. It is not so much a Negro History Week as it is a history week. We should emphasize Not Negro history, but the Negro in history. What we need is not a history of selected races or nations, but the history of the world void of national bias, race hate, and religious prejudice. His last sentence is powerful. This is from 1927, the year after he started it. He says, there should be no indulgence in undue eulogy of the Negro. Don't feel sorry for us. We don't need your pity. He says, the case of the Negro is well taken care of when it is shown how he has influenced the development of civilization. So don't do anything special, just tell the facts. But we know that's not gonna happen. Why? Because the facts are gonna upset the balance. And as I was saying earlier, when Dorothy, when you showed us this National Geographic a couple of weeks ago at the meeting with the Black Pharaohs, as Jacob Carruthers would say, do not snatch defeat from the jaws of victory. The recent National Geographic with Piaye or Pianki, Shabaka, Taharqa, the 25th Dynasty, and Kemet. The Black Pharaohs, of course, take away the adjective black or the article and says what? The Pharaohs. No, it has to be black. Why? They've given us the 25th Dynasty, but we've had that for a long time. The question becomes, why are you conceding the 25th? Because you know imminently we're taking the whole Nile Valley back. And if we look very quickly, even though that's the 25th Dynasty, if you flip through here, you see, and you said it was very interesting, and I agree with you. I took it to Howard. The kids had a great time with this. You see Queen Kawit from the 11th Dynasty getting her locks twisted, sipping on maybe some herbal tea or something a little stronger, I don't know. You know, mirror in other hand, sister in the back, twisting her locks. Got the little pin in there to keep her place. It's not a perm. And then you go a couple of pages later, and the grandmother of Tutankhamun, as Leonard Jeffries always likes to show us this picture, Queen T. And of course, the caption says, did the powerful Queen T, King Tut's grandmother, have Nubian ancestry? This bust, made of wood that has darkened with age, has inspired claims that she did. Like he called himself a professor. They call her black. Meaning what? This ain't 1920. This is not George Wells Parker writing in the Negro History Bulletin about the Greeks. This is not Du Bois writing in 1915, his book, The Negro, where he refutes this stuff. It's 2008, and they still trying to trick black people. But they have a lot of resources. We'll give you the 25th. No, we're taking it all. We will not snatch defeat from the jaws of victory. You understand? Thank you. But thank you. But it goes back to what Woodson said 80 years ago, 81 years ago. The case of the Negro is well taken care of when it is shown how the influence over the entire civilization is there. Just show what we did. No one you do eulogy. And then finally, finally I'll read you the quote from the end of the lesson. I love that quote. It's a beautiful quote. This is a quote from Mary Bethune. Mary Bethune took over the Association for the Study of Negro Life and History for Carter Woodson in the late 1940s, and she was the president of the association when he died. She wrote in 1950, that same issue of the Negro History Bulletin that had the school children in it, Mary Bethune wrote something, and she said, I shall always believe in Carter Woodson. He helped me to maintain my faith in myself. He gave me renewed confidence in the capacity of my race for development and in the capacity of my country for justice, for her own people and for all peoples. With the power of cumulative fact, he moved back the barriers and broadened our vision of the world and the world's vision of us. Now, you know, Ms. Bethune was a dedicated believer in the idea of America, but she wasn't naive. But for her to say that about Woodson was very powerful. Because it spoke to one giant speaking to another one. And she talked really about, in this longer article, she talks about what that influence of Woodson meant to her. Let me give a couple of dates and then wind to a kind of final couple of statements. Woodson was born in New Canton, Virginia, 1875. It's important to note that, in fact, because December 19th, 1875, his mother and father, James and Eliza, had been enslaved. He followed his two older brothers into the coal mines of Virginia, where he worked until he was 20 years old. Then he was finally able to be relieved of the duties of helping the family earn income, and he could finally attend high school full time. He finished that course of study in less than 2 years, went on to college, Berea College in Kentucky. Integrated at the time, but then they went and resegregated after Woodson had left. It's very interesting. His mother and father came out of slavery, but they made sure all of their children, all the boys and girls, learned how to read. Eliza was a stickler about that. You know, it's amazing to me, there are very few books on Woodson, biographies. Jacqueline Goggin has one, Carter G. Woodson, A Life in Black History. In fact, it's the only one. There are articles and things like that, but Woodson, you know. But I remember reading that and thinking about it, because the beautiful thing is that Woodson wrote, he didn't write a lot about himself, but what he wrote about himself really is very telling. I talked about the young people, the little kids. Now let me talk about the elders for a moment. Woodson left home at 17, working first for the railroads and then following his two older brothers into the coal mines of Virginia. One of the men he worked the mines with, Oliver Jones, operated a room in his home stocked with fruit, drinks, and ice cream for the other miners. When Woodson let it be known he could read, he assumed his next community service role. In exchange for free goodies, Woodson read the newspapers to those men. In exchange for reading the newspapers to those men told them the stories of their lives. And they told Woodson the stories about, among other things, being veterans of the Civil War. Woodson made a promise to them that one day, if he ever got into space, he would repeat those stories for posterity. The reason I know that is because you can read his article, My Recollection of Veterans of the Civil War. It's in the Negro History Bulletin, February 1944. He kept his promise. This is a man who, as a teenager, read to old folks who became older men to him, but who had passed away by the time he got in the place where he could tell their story, but he kept his promise to them. This was his dedication. Our history isn't just our experiences. In fact, it's not our experiences. It's the experiences of our people. This was Woodson's primary objective in starting the Journal of Negro History. Let me continue. So he came out of that coal mine. He finishes high school. He goes to teach school. Now, there's another book called Carter G. Woodson, A Biobibliography by Sister Anthony Scally. It's a nun who wrote this piece. In her chronology, she has, and I haven't been able to track this down anywhere else, it has in 1897, from September to December, he attended Lincoln University. Yeah, so I've been looking for that. Now, I haven't been out to Lincoln yet. I'm sure they know about it. But he was only there for several months, if he was there at all. I have no reason to doubt Sister Scally, because she wrote this book a long time ago when people who knew Carter Woodson were still alive. And it could have been that he was enrolled there for a while. But what is clear is that in 1898, for 2 years, he taught school in Winona, West Virginia. One of the things we gave the school teachers last year was a copy of Carter G. Woodson's teacher certification. And we said, look at his certification and look at yours. All the subjects he had to know, grammar and geometry. And this is to teach in the West Virginia segregated public schools. And the marks he achieved, 97, 93, 92, 98. It's like this guy across the board. Now you go teach. He was a public school teacher. Then he went to Douglas High School in Huntington, West Virginia for 3 years before he went to the University of Chicago. He left the University of Chicago in 1903 and taught in the Philippines for 4 years. This is all public schools. This is important to know. Woodson was a school teacher. He was a scholar, but he's a teacher. He honed his craft as a teacher before he went into full-bred scholarship. Came back to the University of Chicago, went to graduate school there, got the master's in August 1908, and from there went to Harvard for a year. He completed the coursework for a PhD in a year. This is a man who came out the coal mine in West Virginia. You understand? So, I mean, it's a beautiful story. I mean, when I think of three of the most important people in our intellectual history in terms of educators, Mary Bethune coming out of the fields of South Carolina. You know, Benny Mays up the road from her in 96 South Carolina, coming out of a tobacco field, was 20 years old before he could go to high school. And Carter G. Woodson out the coal mines in West Virginia. There's no excuse. You ask young people, when do you expect to graduate? I got left back. I'm going to graduate when I'm 20. Okay, Woodson started when he was 20. It's okay. In other words, if you make up your mind, this is why we wanted to use Woodson, right? Not just for what he did, but how he did it. So young people can read this and realize it's never too late. That's right. You know. And then if you work hard enough, you can do things other people say, wow, it's just Harvard. What is Harvard to me? Wilson was the second black person to get a PhD from Harvard. The first was Du Bois, but he was the first and will be the only one ever to be the one, a son of enslaved Africans. Because Du Bois' parents were born out in Massachusetts. And Du Bois didn't know his father. His father got his mother pregnant. They stayed around for a while and then left. Some people said, oh, I don't know my father. Neither did Du Bois. What's your point? This is not an issue. Do your work. Do your work. Ain't nobody standing there saying, you can't work. Put that book down. And there was a time when that was true, both of those things. So at any rate, Woodson then goes to D.C. He teaches at the M Street School, which is now Dunbar School. Oh, yeah, he taught at high school there. And Junior Cooper taught there, too. They taught school. Then he went to Howard, said, nah, Went, bought that house, started his work. 1914, he joined the American Negro Academy. By then, the ANA had been around for almost 20 years. It was founded in 1897, along with the Yonkers Society for Historical Research in 1911, and Philadelphia's own Society for Historical Research, 1897, I guess it is. I heard somebody say during Kwanzaa that after the fall of the University of Sankore at Timbuktu, there were no libraries or learned societies for black people until the appearance of this society in Philadelphia in 1897. This person claimed to be a scholar. It's really an embarrassment for anybody to say that, if say they're a student of African history. But I understand where it came from, trying to get a rise out of the crowd. Black people have always had these spaces. What distinguishes Woodson's space from many of the other spaces is that he was calling for black people who had gone to university to use those skills for the community. Because, you know, if that little parlor in Jones's house where the ice cream and sodas were, where he was reading to those men, is not a study group, I don't know what is. In fact, that's a more important study group. Because these guys said, okay, young buck, you can read. So you sit here and tell us what they said in Richmond. What's in the Planet? What's in the Indianapolis, what's the name of the Indianapolis Recorder? What's in the New York Age? Read to us. And Woodson is doing his duty. So at any rate, we could talk about a number of the books that he published. 1915, he publishes not the Miseducation of the Negro, the Education of the Negro prior to 1915. In that book, he praises Booker T. Washington. He liked Booker T. Washington a lot. He liked Marcus Garvey a lot. There are people, you know, we got pros and cons on both sides of the issue, but the Miseducation of the Negro was not published until 1933. So 18 years before the Miseducation of the Negro, which, by the way, if he knew this was the one book that we all know he wrote, I think Woodson might get violent, physically violent, because these were newspaper articles in the Miseducation of the Negro that got put into a book. And he didn't mean for this to be his legacy, I'm sure, although he'd be satisfied to know that people are still reading something he wrote. He was a historian. So before he wrote the Miseducation of the Negro, he wrote the Education of the Negro prior to 1860, meaning what? Before the Civil War was over, black people were educating each other. If you read James Anderson's book, The Education of the Negro in the South, what you find is that when the so-called Freedmen's Bureau came south and was like, we want to help y'all, black people said two things. Number one, we already started. There's a school in Virginia was started in 1833 by a black woman, deep up in slavery. Enslaved. How did you start a school for black people in 1830, 32 years before the end of the Civil War? So the first thing they said was, we've already started. And the second thing they told them was, thanks, but no thanks. You see, we have experience with white people. And so we'll take some money, but what we don't need is your teachers. And so what you see in the Freedmen's Bureau records is they're writing back saying these Negroes don't want us to teach their children. They said, we'll take the money, but we don't need the teachers. So it's very interesting. You know, I mean, you know our attitude toward that now. But you can imagine if we came out of slavery and then white people said, we're going to help you. No, it's all right. Thanks. You've helped enough. I'm speaking English. You're understanding it. I can understand what you're saying. It's cold. I'm ashy. No, you helped enough. Quite enough. Let us teach our children. Woodson writes a book about that in 1915. He also starts the Association for the Study of Negro Life and History with its meetings. Very quickly, just a couple of quick ones. 1926, he started Negro History Week, and that's the year he got the Spingarn Medal. 1937, he started the Negro History Bulletin. And if I had to pick three books that he did of nearly two dozen manuscripts, either he wrote, co-authored or helped to put into print. I would say that, let me see if I could pick a couple. Yeah. Two that'll count as one. Negro Orations and Their Orators and The Mind of the Negro. These are two books. Negro Orations and Orators is the speeches black people gave in the 18th century, the 19th century. It's a big old thick book of just speeches. John Russ Worm, Mariah Stewart, you know, Henry Highland Garnett. He said, I'm just gonna put a little preface on this and just fill up the book with speeches. Here, Frederick Douglass. Go read what black people said. This is when he did, in the Journal of Negro History, much of what he would do, I would just publish documents. In fact, he would put something in the journal and say, send us your documents, black people. If you got stuff in your attic, in your basement, letters from your family, send it to us, we'll publish it. We just want to put it out there so that you can go and look for yourself. The other one, The Mind of the Negro, was letters black people wrote to each other. The Mind of the Negro, as reflected in letters written during the crisis, 1800 to 1860. Just correspondence. Now I'm wondering today, here we are in 2008, and I'm saying people are teaching African-American history and talking about Carl G. Woodson and say the miseducation of the Negro. I'm like, no, just go get those two volumes, two big old telephone books worth of stuff. He's not even writing, he's just putting the stuff out. Two more books, oh, I love this one. Negro Makers of History, which was published with another book called African Myths, Together with Proverbs. These are books for children. He wrote a book called African Myths, Together with Proverbs. This is a book that if you take it, I use it sometime for Freedom School in the summertime. I go out to a site, all elementary school children, and take that book and have one read the story, and others got to act it out. I need five people. And they'll pick a story out of there, and they act it out. And every proverb, every story in there at the end has a question. One the kids did one summer, I remember, this is about 2-3 years ago. The story of the princess and the three suitors, and the three suitors wanted the princess, so each one of them tried to do something to the princess, and it didn't work. And at the end of the day, some kind of way, they ended up tricking each other. And then Woodson stops the story. Then the question becomes, what should each of them do now to achieve their goal? And to see these little 7, 8, 9-year-old black girls and boys trying to figure out what, this was Woodson's point. It ain't about telling you the end of the story, I'm gonna fill this book up and make you think. Now this book was published in 1928. We got children's literature now that's brilliant. We got some stuff that's worthless. But Woodson's book is not in print. And I dare say that the original copies of it, including anything he may have signed, are now at Emory. But at any rate, finally, The Miseducation of the Negro, of course. Woodson got so mad at black people by 1932, 33. He had fought with all his buddies, a couple of highlights in that. 1932, in fact, this was published in 33.
That's it for Africa World Now Project for this week. I would like to thank you for joining us today and look forward to spending time with you next week. We can be reached through all your regular social media platforms. Email africaworldnowproject@gmail.com or follow us on Twitter at AFWRLDNWPRJ. I'm your host and producer, James Pope. The Africa World Now Project Collective consists of international media journalist, executive producer, and human rights activist, Moise Mutali, Africa World Now Project media correspondent, Funda Ngunda, senior research, content contributor, and production director, Dr. Tasneem Siddiqui, senior researcher, and content contributor and production associate, Dr. Josh Myers, associate producer and content contributor, Dr. Keisha Khan Perry, technology advisor is Byron Gray of GrayWorks Technology, and creative director is Judah Pope. Africa World Now Project is heard every Wednesday at 7 p.m. on WSNC, NPR affiliate and broadcasting service of Winston-Salem State University. Shows are archived weekly on SoundCloud. Search Africa World Now Project. Until next week, be safe, be peaceful, and above all, be intelligent.